This is 91.7 FM WSUM Madison. Welcome to Ideas for Change, a new talk show where we don't just discuss environmental issues, we talk to people who are working towards solutions. I'm your host, Rachel Kastenberg. The topic of today's show is Texaco's oil drilling in Ecuador and the consequent damages to human health and the rainforest. And I'm very pleased to introduce our guest. Cristobal Bonifaz is the lead attorney in a class action lawsuit filed against Texaco on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorians. So thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And I would like to start out by just having you describe briefly the history behind the oil development in Ecuador.
Well, the history, it is not really one oil spill. It's about hundreds and hundreds of oil spills. They can be categorized as that because technically when you talk about a spill, you're actually talking about a non-intentional act that's just happened because of negligence. What happened in Ecuador was an intentional dumping of oil. And let me explain to you what that was. When Texaco, the rainforest of the Amazon was virgin territory in 1969. I mean, it was completely uninhabited. There were a few aboriginal tribes in the region that nobody had any contact with. However, the government of Ecuador, by suggestion of Texaco, decided to explore this region in 1969, and they actually did some seismic studies of the region, and they found that there was oil in there, and they signed a contract with the company Texaco Incorporated to explore the oil. At the time that this was done in 1973, Ecuador was a country with no technology at all. I mean, it was completely virgin with regard to what technology was needed. And so the contract in which the Ecuador entered with Texaco Incorporated and Gulf, by the way, there were two companies involved, was the following. You know, Ecuador would get one-third of the profits, and Texaco would take one-third of the profits. Gulf would take one-third of the profits. Texaco will be in charge at all times of all the operations in Ecuador and all the exploration, extraction of oil, and so forth. And Texaco, because they had the technology and 100 years of experience, they will dictate how it was going to, the extraction was going to be carried out. And this is exactly what happened. Texaco went in, and altogether they eventually drove roads through the rainforest. They paid no attention whatsoever to the nature of the Amazon rainforest. They cut through wetlands. They interrupted water flows. But that damage was nothing compared to what they did to the, while they extracted the oil. I mean, in the United States, when you extract oil from the ground, the oil always comes up with water from the depths of the soil where the oil is located. In Ecuador, that oil is located about 10,000 feet or 3,000 feet into the ground. When you pull that oil out, the oil comes up with water. That is what, in the trade, that's called water of formation. This water of formation contains up to 5,000 parts per million of oil, which you can't separate, in other words. So the way oil extraction takes place in the United States, you pull the water and oil to the surface. You separate by an easily decantation procedure the oil from the water, and you put the water that is contaminated with oil back into the ground. Now, the contamination of this water with oil is part of the contamination of the water. In addition to that, this water that comes from the depth of the ground contains many heavy metal salts like cadmium, mercury, and things like that, and it's extremely toxic. In the United States, it's classified as a toxic product. And in no circumstances that water is allowed to leave the facility. It's re-injected into the ground and it's left where it came from. In Ecuador, Texaco decided to make a little bit of extra money, and they decided not to provide the facilities for re-injection of the water down into the depths of the soil where the oil came back. And what they did instead is they created the process for the production of oil that had been banned in the United States as far back as 1927. And what that process was is simply to dump the oil and the water into decantation ponds, and separate the oil from the water, and then the water production that contained oil was just dumped into the environment. The dumping into the environment took the different way. The process was as follows. They dug up some pits, and all together in the Amazon right now, There are close to 400 pits led by Texaco. These pits are about 1 to 15 acres in size. And
wow.
They dump the water production into these pits. And when you dump the water production into these pits in a continuous basis for weeks and months, the amount of oil that is in this water begins to decant to the surface. And so when you come over and you look at the Amazon, you see all these pits that contain this decanted oil, because the water that has decanted to the bottom is actually dumped into the environment. So you have these oil pits, and this oil is not usable for any purpose because it's so contaminated with heavy metals. And so they left all these oil ponds, what I call them, all over the region. The oil eventually, of course, contaminates the rivers, contaminates the rainforest. The impact of that is not only visual. They have killed thousands of acres of rainforest. They have left 250 lakes of oil in the rainforest. This oil continues to contaminate the environment, and that people live there. And these people that have to drink this water, the contaminated water, people have done studies, the government have done studies that shows a very elevated rates of cancer. The Harvard Medical School sent a team there in 1993. They came back with the conclusion that the risk of cancer for people living in this pristine, or formerly pristine rainforest, was 1 in 1,000, when the permissible rate in the United States is 1 in 1,000,000. In other words, out of 1,000,000 exposures, you get one cancer in the United States. Out of 1,000 exposures, you get one cancer in the Amazon. So this is the result, and the company really profited. It would have cost the company what it costs anywhere else in the world, anywhere from $2 to $4 per barrel to reinject the water of production into the environment,
and
into the soil. And this is a profit that the company made, you know, so close to a few billions of dollars in profit they made over the period of time they were there.
And you sort of mentioned this, but what was the area in Ecuador that they drilled? It was the Ecuadorian Amazon?
Yeah, it's the Amazon Basin. It's an area that encompasses about 100 kilometers long, which is about 60 miles long by 40 miles wide. And this is where the region where all the roads were built, where all the oils, all dogs, the wells were dug, and where all the lakes are located.
And how long did Texaco Gulf drill in Ecuador?
Well, the Gulf eventually was purchased by Texaco. So the company that was responsible was really Texaco. And they carried on this process for 20 years. And they finally left in 1992.
Okay. And you also already talked about this briefly, but could you describe the specific differences between how Texaco operated in the U.S. versus what they did in Ecuador?
Yes, of course. Now, the big difference is, of course, that if you operate in the United States, you don't see lakes of oil. Well, you can go to any place in the United States and you can see this oil production facilities. You can see wells where the stuff is getting pumped out of the ground, and you don't see lakes of oil next to it. That's because the water of production that comes up with the oil gets reinjected into the ground. And here in the Amazon, they just dumped it, and so you have the stuff all over the place.
And you also already mentioned some of this, but there were many ill human health effects, both to indigenous people who already inhabited the Oriente and to settlers who, as I believe, had actually been encouraged by the Ecuadorian government to settle in the Amazon. So could you talk a little bit more about...
Yeah, well, there's a number of diseases these people suffer from. The primary disease they suffer from is cancer. There's a great deal of cancer because of the exposures to the oil. Oil is a carcinogen mixture, and it produces cancer. There's other diseases that people have to. I mean, the one thing I haven't mentioned is that once you have those oil ponds in the ground, you have to make an effort to get rid of the oil that is sitting on top of those ponds. And Texaco created three ways of disposing of this oil. One was just simply letting it run off into the rivers. A lot of this oil they deposited on the bottom of the rivers and killed the fish. The Napo River is the main river that collects all the water from the shed. And the Napo River is the size of the Cheyenne River in Wyoming. And that river's dead. There's no fish there. A lot of people that used to live from the fishery are now starving.
It's completely dead due to this dumping?
Yeah. That river has no fish. Now, the other way that the Texaco did this is they actually set those ponds on fire. You know, that every once in a while when the thing got to, the oil accumulated on the surface, they had no way of getting rid of it. It's oil that cannot be processed because of the heavy metal salts that contaminated catalytic converter in the refineries. So what they did is actually set the things on fire. Now, we all are aware what happens when you set oil on fire. I mean, we are aware of what happened in Kuwait in the war. We're aware of what's happening now in the war in Iraq when the oil goes on fire. When oil goes on fire, it produces only partial combustion. When you have only partial combustion, you produce a lot of dioxins, which are carcinogenic. You produce a phenomenon in the rainforest that's called black rain. People all over the region complain of the black rain. It's because these oil wells, these oil ponds are set on fire because that's the only way they have to disposing it. But the worst thing that Texaco did with regard to disposal of this oil was that they took it, they devised a process, and this, I think, is unique for the country. I mean, this is one of these Texas geniuses from Texaco who designed this diabolic process, which consisted on the tankers that picked up the oil, skimmed the oil from the surface of the ponds, and put it into tankers, and then they just simply spread it on top of the road, on the dirt roads in the Amazon. Now, what that did is tragic, because most of the sellers and most of the people that live in the region sell a lot on the roads. Now, when you put oil, crude oil, on the roads, then oil has, and you have a region in the Amazon where it rains, 2 inches of water per day. When you did that, you know, that oil ran off the road, and then went into the seller's land and contaminated everything. You know, and this is what causes the disease, the constant exposure to oil. The Harvard team that went there in 1993 found that there was no water anywhere suitable for drinking, including the rainwater. The rainwater was contaminated because of the black rain.
So not only was their water completely contaminated, but also the roads that they walked on and the areas they settled in.
That's right. And you can see photographs there. You can go and watch yourself. People don't have shoes. You know, people are poor. The indigenous people do not wear anything on their feet. And they walk on these roads. They had the cake. The oil tend to cake at the bottom of the soles. Of the soles of their feet. And what Texaco did now is provide these people with buckets of gasoline, you know, that then refine, and they say, okay, well, here's a bucket of gasoline, you must wash your feet before you go into your house. And these people actually had to, you know, were soaked their feet, get rid of the oil in these buckets of gasoline at the doors of the house. And this is an incredible, I don't know how to describe this. This is the most crass way of treating people, because what happened when you give poor people a bucket of gasoline and people that are not experienced with gasoline or the flammable properties of it, is that, of course, that thing sets on fire once in a while. And, you know, there's a little hospital in Coca that takes care of a population of about 30,000 people. It has 14 beds on it. 10 of the beds are usually taken up by people who are being burned severely by this practice of giving people gasoline to wash their oil from their feet that sticks to their feet walking on the roads. So those are all consequences of this. What happened in Ecuador is one of the most crass behaviors of an American corporation ever. I mean, and I haven't seen anything comparable, you know, in my lifetime anywhere in the world. Because, you know, you look at Bhopal and what happened in Bhopal and how many people died as a result of the exposure to this compound. But no matter how you cut it, you know, there may have been negligence in that factory. And this was an accident. It was not intended. What happened in Ecuador was intended. These people didn't care. They knew they dumped the oil. They knew that if they put it on the roads, it would cause exactly this damage. They knew that in the United States, where they had practiced before, if they did that, they'd probably go to jail. And yet over there, they went over there and they did it. And they, you know. And so that's what is so crass about what Texaco did. It's outrageous.
Okay, I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking with Cristobal Bonifaz, the lead attorney in a class action lawsuit filed against Texaco on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorians. And I wanted to just ask one follow-up question about the roads, and actually another environmental impact of Texaco's actions, besides all the toxins that they dumped, were the roads that they cleared to get into gain access to the oil. So could you talk a little bit about the impact of these roads?
Well, I can tell you from a personal viewpoint, you know, the Amazon region was a virgin region. I mean, you couldn't go there. I mean, if you wanted to go into the region, you had to go on horseback and you had to walk. Well, you know, these people came in with the bulldozers, you know, and when the bulldozer comes in into the Amazon, into the rainforest, it destroys everything. People don't understand how delicate the environment is in the rainforest. A rainforest like the Amazon, it consists of a clay surface that does not permit the water to seep in. So most of the water stays on the surface. Most of the trees stays, the roots are on the surface. The topsoil in the Amazon is nothing but about a couple of inches. And so when you remove the canopy of trees that create the moisture and the environment in which the birds and the animals fly, once you take all those trees down, when you bulldoze the roads down into the clay surface, you know, you destroy the rainforest forever. It's not recoverable. You cannot put topsoil in the rainforest and then go back to growth of plants. Once you take the trees down, you're destroying the region. You're turning into a desert. And everybody knows this. Every environmental engineer in the world knows this. And yet when Texaco went into Ecuador, they had no concern whatsoever for anything. They put the bulldozer in, they bulldozed those huge, magnificent trees. They took all of everything down. They actually took the trees and put it on the road, covered them up with more clay from the surface, and then that's where people drive cars in now. And on top of that, of course, they put the oil. This is what they did. And when they created those roads, of course, they invited the poor people from the mountains to come down on the theory that people that are starving for a little bit of land will go to the Amazon and then claim a piece of ground. But you see, there is nothing to claim. People came to the rain from the mountains. They claim a piece of rainforest. They try to cultivate it. In 5 years, it's all gone. There's no soil. There's no topsoil to grow anything. So what we have now is 30,000 subsistence farmers, subsistence farmers that have went over there under the theory that they're going to live off this beautiful land, which has turned out to be in arid pastures once you took the trees down. The coffee plants that people plant, they last about 5 years in the region where you have proper subsoil. The coffee plants should last 20 or 30 years.
So this leads to sort of a downward spiral as people leave their fallow land behind and then begin to cultivate other areas. It just increases the destruction of the rainforest.
That's correct. That's right.
And, okay, I'd like to switch gears a little bit here and talk about the Ecuadorian government. And throughout this time period when Texaco was drilling, the government lacked a degree of stability or legitimacy. Could you discuss the different transitions?
I think we have to say two things, you know. I mean, the development of oil in Ecuador, as the development of oil in any other country, like even Venezuela, which is so rich in oil, is a disaster. It is truly a disaster for the people of the country for a number of reasons. First of all, it is, again, you know, this theory that in which these countries were founded, in which the Spaniards that came to South America came to conquer, to steal the gold, to rip the land, to take all the gold from the indigenous people and go back to Spain and build their churches and their castles. And I think the principle on those countries is the same. I mean, today, when El Dorado means the gold land, you know, and when you claim that you have El Dorado in Ecuador, when all of a sudden you had all this richness that were going to come, you know, you destroy everything. You destroy the infrastructure because people think we don't need to pay taxes anymore. We can just live off this gold that's going to come from the Amazon. And what happened in the country was a disaster. First of all, there was, you know, as soon as the Texaco came in, pretty soon you had a military regime. A military regime was going to absorb all the goodies, all those military people that were going to run the country in the 1970s when Texaco was there, you know, pay themselves enormous salaries. They all ended up multimillionaires. I don't know how, because theoretically the salaries they take are supposed to be controlled. But it was a total corruption, and Texaco knew they were dealing with corrupt people. In a sense, You know, there's a responsibility these American companies should have. You cannot go abroad and deal with gangsters. And this is basically what happened. And because they were dealing with people that were not elected, this was a dictatorial regime you had in Ecuador at the time, you know, they allowed this to happen because everybody was getting rich and the country was going to nowhere. And the country, they said, well, what are we going to do with all this money? So they built roads to nowhere. They built roads in the Andes to nowhere. The roads are there, still use the same level of use as they had before. The country became poorer because they began to use the money to import goods from the abroad, It was a self-sufficient country agriculturally. And then when you destroy the agriculture of the country by moving people from one place to another where there was no agriculture production, pretty soon you start importing food. And so the oil development in Ecuador was a disaster for the people of the entire country, and no matter how anybody cuts it. Eventually, this military regime, you know, late in the 1980s, they become, once the regime becomes totally subservient to the oil industry, which is what happens in these countries, you begin to realize, well, where is this money going that this country is making? And you begin to analyze it, you realize that, you know, in Ecuador, the oil concession in the Amazon right now, it is owned by the Ecuadorian army. I mean, Ecuador needs an army that can eat a hole in the head. They don't need an army for anything. They don't have a war. They don't have anybody attacking them. They have an army with generals and colonels and captains and the whole gamut of stuff. And there's no need for any of these people. And yet these people are living off the oil. They actually own the oil concession. 50% of the government revenues come from oil, and 50% of the government revenues go to pay for the army. So in other words, what you have here is a landowner, which is the Ecuadorian army, which is a totally useless entity that serves no purpose whatsoever. And I think that they have destroyed the country, because how is the country ever going to get back? Once you have an entity, it's like having a landlord that owns everything and he says, this is my money, I'm not going to let anybody have it. And this is what the army does. So the country doesn't benefit at all from this oil.
Okay, and I think it's interesting to note that actually during this time when Texaco was drilling, that there were several environmental laws on the books in Ecuador.
Oh, yeah, there was a constitution that said that, first of all, there was a... No, listen, there's a lot of stuff here. You know, people don't understand. You know, when Texaco entered into the contract, the original contract with the then dictatorial government in Ecuador, there was a clause in that contract. The clause in the contract basically says that Texaco will be responsible for any damage to the environment. They put that clause in, but they never abide by it. The government never enforced it. And this is one of the things we maintain. We maintain that if you have a contract that says you don't cause damage to the environment, you knowingly, fully well, that you could have done it differently, and you went ahead and did it, you should pay for it. You should be responsible. All we're asking is that Texaco take some of those profits that they made, because they made over $30 billion in profits. And we're saying, take some of those profits, go back and clean those ponds up, and get the hell out of there.
And since you just mentioned the suit, could you describe in a little more detail the class action lawsuit? I believe one of them is Aguinda versus Texaco, that you are the lead attorney for, filed on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorians.
Yeah, well, the lawsuit has got a typical adventure to the courts that any lawsuit here that goes against a major American corporation, you know. I mean, major American corporations that, they live off the land. They are eternal entities compared to people that die, and they have unlimited funds. And they part of their doing business is to finance it, the cadre of attorneys that do nothing but defend them from every possible the damage that they cause all over the world. Now, we filed this lawsuit in 1993 in the courts, and we had a very good judge. Judge Vincent Broderick was a judge that was former police commissioner in New York, appointed by President Ford. He took a look at the lawsuit and says, yeah, this is terrible. I mean, I'm going to let this lawsuit go forward. And we went forward. And the rule on our side, the Texaco made a major force. They even went to the then government of Ecuador and asked the government of Ecuador to send a letter to the court telling the court not to intervene because this is a national sovereignty on the country. I mean, the only national sovereignty there was the amount of money these people were putting in their pockets in Ecuador at the time. So the judge went in our way, and we proceeded with discovery. And unfortunately, tragically for the people of the Amazon, Judge Broderick passed away within 2 years, and we got reassigned. And we got reassigned to a former judge, to a judge that he was a former white-collar defender in New York City, who had written extensively about, you know, how corporations should not be liable for damages they cause to people or the environment. For some.
And who assigns these judges?
This is, I like to know that myself. It's a mystery to me how a judge with such views got appointed to my case. And there's more to it. And that judge got appointed to my case. That judge dismissed the case. Now we appealed it. The judge got reversed. But while I appealed, the judge got reversed. The Court of Appeals ordered the judge to look at this case again. And then the judge decided that he already got in reversed by the Court of Appeals. He was going to let the case sit there for 2 years. And the case, he wasn't going to decide anything. He was just going to let the things hanging. We're now in 1998. This judge had had the case for 4 years, and he had done nothing, and not even let the case go forward. He had dismissed it. He got reversed by the Court of Appeals, and now he was sitting on it. And then I found out through casual connections that he had spent while he was had this case on his docket, he had actually spent 2 weeks at a resort with the chairman of the board of Texas Incorporated, Mr. DeCrane, and that he had, you know, they were horseback riding and eating and doing things like that. And I asked for the court to, I asked the judge to recluse himself from the case, given that this was a terrible conflict of interest. He was actually immoral, unethical for a judge to spend 2 weeks with the chairman of the board of Texaco in some resort in Montana, horseback riding and having dinners and cocktails together for 10 days. But, of course, the judge refused to say. His argument was, well, I never discussed this case with them. Well, I mean, what did he talk to them about? And then I appealed it, and the Court of Appeals said that when you attack a judge in the federal courts, you know, all these judges, they group together like rabbits, you know, and so they all got together and said, no, the judge didn't do nothing wrong. I haven't proven that he did nothing wrong. But the theory is, I mean, the New York Times had an editorial, you know, about this. It says that this judge, the appearance of impartiality is totally defeated. I mean, it's not just whether or not, I could never prove whether he talked or didn't talk to Mr. DeCrane, the chairman of the board of Texaco, about this. All I know is he spent time with him. I mean, take the other side of the coin. Suppose one of my Indian leaders have come and spent 10 days with the Judge Rakoff at a resort motel. I mean, you know, can you imagine this? What Texaco will have done, you know?
Right.
They will have crucified him. And yet I couldn't do anything about it. The Court of Appeals sustained him and let him go with the case. And, of course, he dismissed it again. So now the case, I appealed it again to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said, okay, I figured that there was nothing we can do here anymore. He seemed, given the fact that I was going to end up back with the same judge, we have been this judge for 4 years, and, you know, given the fact the Court of Appeals refused to recuse him, so we decided to just move the case to Ecuador. We got the Court of Appeals to rule that if we wanted to go file the case in Ecuador, Texaco had to subject itself to jurisdiction of the country. And that's where we're going now, and the next in the next month, we're going to reopen the case in Ecuador. We are all ready. We have taken satellite photographs of the 450 lakes. We have done enormous studies of medicinal studies of the cancers, and we're going to present all this to an Ecuadorian judge. Unfortunately for Texaco, the situation in Ecuador has changed. It's a matter of fact that one of the bigger supporters we had in the government was the Indian organization, the CONAI, in Ecuador when we were fighting the government of Ecuador at the time. Now, fortunately for us, the CONAI is in government. The whole country is on our side. I mean, even taxi drivers, everybody can't wait for Texaco to be forced to pay, because everybody who looks at the Amazon right now is outraged. What happened there is just it doesn't take me to explain it. All you have to do is look at it, and you know that it was wrong. And so we're going to reopen the case in Ecuador, and I'm sure now that we're going to force Texaco to go back and clean it up.
Okay, and we only have time for one more question. I would just like to ask you, With this horrible situation in Ecuador, what are some of the things that can be done internationally to aid these lesser developed nations, such as Ecuador, so that they don't have to make these kinds of choices between oil revenues and, you know, their human population or the environment?
I think the key to this whole thing is that when these contracts are written between foreign oil companies and governments, they should be a third party part of this contract. That third party should even be environmental groups and that understand what the impact is going to be, and they should have a say on this contract before they are signed. Because as long as you have a contract between a corrupt government and a corrupt company, the people are going to suffer. So these people that are going to suffer have to be part of this contract, so that all that happened in Ecuador can be prevented. ARCO went into Indonesia the same time that Texaco went into Ecuador, and they exploited oil in Indonesia, millions of barrels, and they didn't do any of the damage that Texaco did. So you don't have to do this damage if you're willing to not to make as much money. Unfortunately, the people in Texaco at the time were a bunch of greedy people that all they wanted to do is put more money in their pockets and the pockets of the shareholders. And, you know, Texaco is a company with a very bad reputation. I mean, they lost the case against Pennzoil Oil in 87 for $11 billion for some shenanigans they did during some deal about shareholders. But so, in other words, what we need is on the most important thing the world can do is these companies have to be accountable for what they do somewhere, and people should be part of these contracts, and they should insist to be part of these contracts. Everybody who's dealing with these issues should say, you can't do that. And American companies have to be held accountable somewhere for what they do.
All right, great. Well, I want to really thank you, Cristobal Bonifaz, who is the lead attorney in the class action lawsuit Aguina versus Texaco, and he's talking with us today from Amherst, Massachusetts. So thank you for being on Ideas for Change with me, Rachel Kastenberg, and this is 91.7 FM WSUM Madison.